Hello, welcome to the show called The Environment. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with SunSounds of Arizona. I'm going to be reading articles from the Nature Conservancy magazine. This is the issue number 4 of the 2024 edition. So issue number 4. The article is entitled Channeling the Past to Face the Future. This is written by Matt Jenkins for the Nature Conservancy. And the subtitle is In the Peruvian Andes, Pre-Incan Canals Are Being Restored to Capture Runoff as Part of a Return to Traditional Nature-Based Water Management. Here's the article. On an October morning in the Peruvian Andes, the sound of chisels striking against stone rings bright in the thin mountain air. Here, some 12,500 feet above sea level, a crew of a dozen people works from a makeshift camp, a cluster of tents pitched amid the rock and the grass on an ankle-twisting hillside, high above the Santa Eulalia River. The landscape is, in turns, raked by the blazing sun and swept by frigid wind and clouds. The crew labors forward, digging a trench in the soil with pickaxes and shovels, and then carefully setting stones in place for reinforcement, slowly extending the 1.5-foot-wide canal across the mountainside. Their work has roots that reach back over a millennium and builds on the nearly vanished traces of the pre-Incan canals known as Amunas, A-M-U-N-A-S. On the ground ahead of the work crew, a line of red spray paint lays through the grass and the brush, highlighting the path of the final 650 feet of this canal. On close examination, it is still possible to make out traces of the original Amuna that was here. It was known as Pilquancha, a faint, weathered depression in the ground, dating from more than 1,400 years ago. Leda Garcia, a watershed management assistant for the Nature Conservancy, she splits her time between the Nature Conservancy's office in Lima and the remote work sites like this one. Leda said, quote, "It's not like we just got anywhere and said, let's make an Amuna here. This is ancestral, pre-Incan infrastructure that was lost to the rains and the passage of time until practically no trace was left, and now we are recovering it. The canal here, which will run about 1.5 miles, will bank enough water each year to supply more than 7,000 people. It is part of a system of Amunas totaling more than some 32 miles that have been rehabilitated throughout the highlands outside of Lima over the past several years. This is one of numerous places throughout Peru where the Nature Conservancy and other organizations are working to restore traditional water management systems, as well as developing new, nature-based approaches to increase water supply and improve water quality for both people and nature. Some of these projects, such as this one, help stabilize and augment water supplies for the urban areas like Lima. Others are aimed at providing cleaner water to small mountain communities. In addition to restoring Amunas, these organizations and local communities are rehabilitating traditional small-scale reservoirs and restoring native wetlands, which act like natural water filters and remove metals and other toxins. They're also improving livestock grazing practices, closing off sensitive grasslands, as well as restoring forest and grasslands, which increases the landscape's sponginess and helps to absorb water. Together, these initiatives show the promise of new and ancient ways of using nature to make every drop count. On the steep mountainside above the Santa Eulalia, Jonathan Perez, a resident of the nearby town of Carampoma, which leads the crew here, explains that rebuilding the Amuna is also a way of reconnecting with the community's lost history. The trail of red spray paint leads toward the original site of Carampoma, which 5 centuries ago was a mountain citadel. Soon after their arrival in the early 1500s, however, the Spanish conquistadors forced the village's native Quechua inhabitants to move to a site further down the valley, where they converted them to Christianity, and where the town of Carampoma remains today. But rehabilitating the Amuna, says Perez, quote, is a way of reviving the customs and traditions of our community and ancestors, unquote. Now, 25 miles down the valley, the town of San Pedro de Costa sits perched over the yawning gorge of Santa Eulalia, as if clinging by its fingernails to the side of the mountain. People here have long maintained an especially strong connection with Amuna culture, which is much more than simply a way of moving water around the mountains. Wearing a weathered felt hat and with a walqui, which is a traditional knit bag filled with ritual items hung around his neck, Gregorio Lopez is a sort of living encyclopedia and keeper of the cultural flame. He explains that Amunas here are tightly intertwined with El Camacho, what he calls the ultimate democracy, a pre-Incan form of community governance that was forced underground under Spanish rule and has largely disappeared elsewhere in the region. Under the Camacho, each member of the community is responsible for the upkeep of the Amuna system. Every October, the people of San Pedro de Costa gather for the Champaria, a week-long community canal-cleaning effort in which everyone has a part. Elaborate homage is paid to the departed ancestors and to Tetachka Yaku, a small naked creature that lives where the water is born. Over the past several years, the people of San Pedro de Costa have restored a dozen Amunas around the town, totaling 15 to 18 miles in length. And those, just like the Pilque Concha Amuna, are providing an important boost to the water supply in Lima, which is Peru's capital on the Pacific coast. From here, the road to Lima is long and steep and twisting. But as the condor flies, the sprawling city is only 50 miles away. And after Cairo, Lima is the second largest desert city in the world. With 10 million people and an average of only 1/3 of an inch of rainfall a year, most of which comes during just 4 months, the city must cover a dry season shortfall of some 41.5 billion gallons each year. Now, Lima has managed to bridge much of the dry season gap with a highly engineered reservoir and tunnel system that siphons water west underneath the continental divide of the Andes, drawing from the water-rich Amazon basin some 60 miles to the city's east. But the rough-hewn Amunas in places like Carampoma and San Pedro de Costa represent a different approach to moving water through the mountains. As more cities find themselves running up against the limits of a water-short world, managers are often single-mindedly obsessed with improving efficiency. The don't-waste-a-drop approach that drives water agencies around the world to ruthlessly chase down and eliminate leakage from their systems. Amunas, which one set of researchers called, quote, a 1,400-year-old indigenous infiltration enhancement system, unquote, they are literally designed to leak. Amunas capture water from mountain streams swollen with rainy season torrents, and then guide the water out across the landscape to the spongiest ground, exactly those spots where the most water will infiltrate into the aquifer below. So by doing so, amunas intercept water that otherwise would run off straight down the hillsides and streams, but instead, it's banked into it as groundwater. Now that process essentially turns aquifers into natural reservoirs that complement the dams and reservoirs at the heart of Lima's water system. The aquifers then slowly release that water through springs further downstream, paralleling the water out over several months beyond the end of the rainy season. In effect, the system is a time release mechanism, a way of stretching the rainy season's bounty over a longer part of the year. Aldo Cardenas, TNC's Peru water coordinator, said, quote, "During the rainy season, you save water in the aquifer, and then, after the dry season starts, that water comes out through the springs," unquote. Well, this not only helps residents in Lima, but also ensures that mountain and aquatic ecosystems have water for a longer period of the year. The use of amunas could also potentially reduce the need for new dams, thereby preserving stream connectivity for fish and other aquatic creatures, and benefiting biodiversity. A Lima-based organization called Aquafondo, established with the help of the Nature Conservancy and other partners, has overseen the on-the-ground amuna restoration work. Funding for the effort has come from Bacchus, Peru's largest brewing company, and GIZ, Germany's International Development Agency, as well as from other large industrial water users like Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, and Caterpillar. The Conservancy, for its part, has been monitoring the performance of the amunas after their rehabilitation. The potential is significant. While small mountain villages like Carampoma and San Pedro de Costa are still able to supply their own needs for seasonal runoff and mountain springs, the amunas can create extra water storage to benefit Lima, which is farther down the watershed. A 2019 paper by researchers affiliated with the Regional Initiative for Hydrological Monitoring of Andean Ecosystems, well, they estimate that if amunas were scaled up across the entire watershed from which Lima draws its supply, they could increase the city's dry season supply of water by 7.5%. So in San Pedro de Costa, the Nature Conservancy is working to refine those estimates with meteorological and hydrometric stations and radar flow meters and fluorescent tracer dyes that, after being released into the amunas, reveal the flow path of water underground. Recently completed monitoring of some 12 miles of amunas near the town has shown that during the dry season, they provide 32% of the water available in the river. During the 2023 rainy season, amunas in the area recharged 647 million gallons of water. Now, on average, the water remains underground for 66 days, in some cases for more than 5 months, before discharging to the river, thereby extending Lima's dry season supplies by an equivalent amount of time. Water capture by amunas also comes at a much lower price than that from conventional steel and concrete infrastructure. At the Nature Conservancy, Cardenas and his colleagues found that a unit of water recharged into the aquifer through an amuna cost about one-third of what a unit of water captured by a new dam that's planned for construction on the Santa Eulalia Rill. Now, some indigenous communities are facing a different water struggle, toxic pollution from glacier runoff. About 150 miles north, in the Cordillera Blanca range of the Andes, Kiera Aguirre looks serious and on point, her eyes shielded under a blue ball cap. She is an engineer with the Instituto de Montaña, which works with communities throughout the Peruvian Andes. Unlike the Amunas outside of Lima, the focus of this project is entirely on the local community called Canray Chico. As global warming accelerates, rapidly melting glaciers in the mountain headwaters are exposing underlying rock that is high in sulfur, which then oxidizes in the open air. And this creates highly acidic glacial runoff, which is also laden with toxic levels of metals like iron, aluminum, cadmium, and arsenic. That orange-tinted witch's brew then flows into local streams and rivers, where farmers and herders get the water upon which their crops and cattle and families depend. Aguirre said, quote, "Compared with contamination from mine effluent, the concentrations are low. But with so much livestock and agriculture here, it goes up the chain and accumulates in people's bodies. The entire population of Canray Chico is affected." Unquote. But just upstream from the village of Canray Chico, in a wooded glen alongside a river at over 12,000 feet, Aguirre shows off what might be a solution to the problem. A stainless steel headgate diverts foamy orange water from the river, slows it, and then gently guides it toward a series of tightly coiled meanders. Those twists and turns are planted with clumps of native reeds known as totorias, and they're full of sulfur-hungry bacteria, through which the water takes a leisurely 6.5-day journey of purification. There is a contemplative air to the system, kind of like some sort of aquatic Zen garden. Aguirre said, as she added with a laugh, quote, "These wetlands are nature-based systems that mimic natural processes and don't require any chemicals. It's just like a big gut." The idea originated with a local community member who noticed that water percolating through native wetlands emerged much cleaner. So, built with help from residents and students and professors from the local university, the concept is decidedly low-tech, and that, it turns out, is another part of its beauty. Aguirre said, quote, "The Ancash region is full of glaciers, and in a few years, climate change is going to be a critical issue for a lot of communities here. A lot of population centers are going to be affected by contamination like this, but they don't have the money to carry out large-scale projects. These are effective, they're cheap to implement, and they're easy for the community to manage." Unquote. Now, the Instituto de Montaña is still refining the design of the water treatment system and gathering data to assess the effectiveness of the approach, just as the Nature Conservancy continues to assess the effectiveness of the newly rehabilitated Amunas outside Lima. But these kinds of low-tech solutions are taking hold throughout the Andes and offering a path toward cleaner and more abundant water for both mountain communities and big cities. Compared with more mainstream, engineering-heavy water management methods, the Nature Conservancy's Garcia said, "It's a totally different approach, but what we're seeing are exciting things starting to happen." And that was the article written by Matt Jenkins, entitled "Channeling the Past to Face the Future." Well, now I'd like to turn to a section of the magazine called The World View, and they have a series of short articles in them. First one is "Song of the Prairie." "From ocelots that prowl the border scrublands to whooping cranes that winter along the coast, the Nature Conservancy is working to protect about 50 endangered plant and animal species across Texas. Among them is the Atwater's prairie chicken. Conservancy staff report an estimated 15% increase this year in the number of male chickens booming, that is, stamping their feet and inflating their mango-colored pouches on their necks in an elaborate mating ritual. This occurring on a 60,000 acres of privately owned coastal prairie habitat. Researchers attribute the success to the favorable seasonable rains, plus partnerships and continued public and private funding of treatments of nesting grounds for invasive red fire ants, which compete with the hatchlings for food. And that little article was written by Pam LeBlanc. Next up, here's a little section entitled By the Numbers. The first number is 70. The approximate number of Oxbow Lake restoration projects in Iowa since 2019. The U-shaped wetlands, sections of water cut off from meandering rivers, provide habitat for the endangered Topeka shiner. The chubby minnows nearly disappeared in the 1990s, but they are making a comeback thanks to joint habitat restoration efforts by the Iowa Topeka Shiner Recovery Partnership and the TNC. Our next number is 2,706. That's the acreage added to the state-managed Mount Abraham Public Reserve land in western Maine. The Nature Conservancy and its partners worked with seven landowners to acquire the land. This follows a 2023 addition of 6,437 acres to a contiguous landscape of more than 100,000 acres conserved for wildlife habitat, sustainable timber harvest, and public recreation. And the final number is 200. 200 remaining Florida panthers that are getting more room to roam in the southwest part of the state thanks to a conservation easement purchased by the Nature Conservancy and the Federal Natural Resources Conservation Service. The land, which includes a citrus grove and a tree nursery, expands the protected area where the endangered cats live, and it stops fragmentation of farmland where they prey, including invasive feral hogs, thrive. And those were the by the numbers. Then there's this other little section. This one now is written by Jennifer Winger. Have you heard? A record number of dams and other barriers were removed from Europe's rivers in 2023, found by a new study published by the World Fish Migration Foundation. According to figures by Dam Removal Europe, a coalition of seven environmental groups, including the Nature Conservancy, 487 barriers were taken out of European waterways last year. That's nearly a 50% increase from the year before. So while the momentum is growing to reconnect Europe's fresh water, the continent still has more than 1 million barriers fragmenting its rivers. But the report says it can take as little as weeks for rivers to return to their unaltered state after dam removal, which can mean improved water quality, a rebounding biodiversity, restored habitats, and increased climate resilience. Scaling up dam removal efforts is also critical to meeting the target set by Europe's new restoration law, which aims to restore approximately 16,000 miles of river by the year 2030. And that was Have You Heard? A record number of dams and other barriers were removed from Europe's rivers in 2023. This next section is called Tracking Leatherbacks, was written by Justine House here. Leatherback turtles are declining across the world's oceans. The population in the Western Pacific is critically endangered, with only an estimated 1,400 breeding adults remaining. If the declines continue on pace, there could be as few as just 100 nesting pairs by the year 2040. Scientists at the Nature Conservancy are working with rangers in the Solomon Islands to monitor the species' nesting beaches. Over the past 2 years, rangers attached satellite tags to 22 nesting female leatherbacks, tracking their movements from the tropics to cold water foraging grounds. Satellite tracks reveal what a perilous journey migration can be. Several turtles temporarily went off course due to a cyclone. One swam 6,000 miles over 6 months. Another one dove more than 4,400 feet below the ocean surface, logging the deepest dive ever recorded by a marine reptile. The data also reveal that the turtles are at risk from longline fisheries in the waters off New Zealand, where vessels fish for big-eye tuna and swordfish in the same area that at least six of the tagged turtles foraged for food. Peter Waldy, director of TNC's Solomon Islands program and the lead scientist on the research, said, quote, "The tagging data shows us that the nesting protection in Solomons and bycatch prevention in southern Australia and New Zealand have to work hand in hand," unquote. Upwell, a TNC partner, is using the satellite data to create a tool that will help predict when and where leatherbacks are likely to appear, so that fishery managers in New Zealand and Australia can use that information to reduce the turtle bycatch. And that was Tracking Leatherbacks by Justine Hauschier. Well, we're at the end of our time together. I'm going to have to say goodbye. I'm Gene, a volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona, and I have been reading from the Nature Conservancy magazine, issue number 4 of 2024, and you have been listening to the show called The Environment. I hope you have a great week ahead, and I hope you keep on listening. Bye-bye.